it did awaken something in me. The path is right there. It's just sequencing a bunch of these different steps that have been proven out time and time again. The scientific method applies to all things. You stop being the person who's doing the actual manipulation of the world. Any creator kind of has the cheat code here, and it's super unfair. Maybe get real about how deeply you want to do some of these things you think you want to do. Nothing matters in that sense, like everything matters.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Kevin Espiritu. Kevin is the founder and CEO of Epic Gardening. We talk about content creation, developing your passion, the Pareto Principle, paradoxes, creating cinematic universes, global food supply chain, and more. Please enjoy.
One of the things that's so fascinating to me about you is that you've successfully built channels, content lines across a variety of mediums. You started with blogging, you did YouTube, short form video, and you did them successfully. What do you feel like is the underlying skill or understanding about like the fundamental principles of content creation that have allowed you to succeed across mediums?
It's very interesting. I actually wish I had a crystallized answer on that, because I truly don't. But I think the ramp that I took kind of prepped me for the next stage. So blogging was a great way to start, maybe not so much today, but back in the day it was. But also writing is a very clear way to articulate thought, right? And so if I had to structure articles, let's say, on how to grow a rosemary tree plant or how to grow an apple tree, well, there's an intro, there's a conclusion, there's some sort of level of copy flow through that piece. There's the structure of, you know, do you talk about water needs first, or do you talk about the history of the plant first, that sort of thing. And so, you know, you do 500-600 reps of writing articles, and if you could make the argument that you've written 600 scripts for YouTube in theory, right? Like, you just have to present that in a different way for video. And then there's, of course, the presentational skills that go into that. And then you could say, well, if you've done the YouTube video on how to grow the apple tree that's 10 minutes long, you really just have to condense it down to the best 34 seconds to make the short form. So it's like expansion and condensation. That's not a word, but expansion and contraction of the content sort of depth per style. And then there's like the individual skill sets of each medium, whether it's podcasts, YouTube, you know, shorts or articles or what have you. There's obviously better ways to present and worse ways to present, or better ways to film or edit, worse ways to film or edit, that you would have to just pick up as you get into that format. So not a great answer, I would say, but basically the reps of writing, I think, was a good foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. I was listening to your episode on it's one of the Colossus network podcasts about media.
Oh, Making Media, yeah.
Making Media. And you had this interesting line on there. I believe it was on that episode where you said you sat in a room for 12 hours a day for 3 months just writing blogs. And I saw some parallels between that. And Kanye has this line where he says he sat in his bedroom for 3 summers making 5 beats a day, and just speaking to this idea of reps.
Yeah.
What do you think it was that allowed you to just hunker down and just focus on the reps when so many people decide to give up and don't have kind of the capacity for creating at that level or that frequency?
I think I really wanted it to work, number one. Like, I genuinely wanted it to happen. So it wasn't like I heard about this idea to start a blog from someone and thought it might be cool, but also had 14 things happening in life and had a girlfriend and, you know, these sorts of things where I could be like, well, if this doesn't work, like, my life's pretty good. Like, there was a lot that wasn't awesome at that time. I had left the job / probably would have been fired if I didn't leave. I had left dating someone. This gym I used to work out at all the time closed down. I decided to move out of my downtown sort of apartment and in with family for a hot minute, and then like in with friends. I was actually living at a friend's house when I was doing that 12 hours a day thing, just sort of renting a quick room. And so it's not like I had anything else to do, number one. I also was obsessed with the craft itself, and also had proof points that it could work from others, like other colleagues and friends of mine that I'd met through the internet were clearly crushing it just having a blog. And so I was like, well, it's not impossible. So I can figure this out. This is a combo of those three things.
You said you were obsessed with the craft, and I may have the timeline wrong here, but I believe you said that the reason you got into gardening was because you just needed a reason to get out of the house, and your brother actually picked that out of a variety of options, which is, I think, contrary to a lot of people's kind of romanticizing of like finding your passion. It's a thing that's kind of just sitting out there waiting for you to grab it. Whereas, and I may be misunderstanding here, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you developed that passion over time. I'm sure there's elements of it that were innate to you or you enjoyed from the beginning. But can you speak to this idea of kind of developing a passion or growing to enjoy a craft versus it kind of always innately being there?
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot, because at the business passion and the garden passion grew, maybe not at the exact same rate, but they were correlated highly, right? And so I've often thought, would I really be so into it if it wasn't also working as a business or vice versa? And I think I would. I mean, I don't think I'll ever not have a garden in my entire life for the rest of my whole days, right? And it might actually get much larger as maybe I get more land or something like that. But you're right. Like, he could have just not picked that. And I would have found it eventually, I'd like to believe. But it could have just been something that, who knows? If he didn't pick gardening, I might have gone back to being addicted to video games for who knows how much longer, until I maybe just decided to get a job or something like that, right? Like, it's really hard to say. I'm very glad he did pick that, and that's what we did. But I would say it did awaken something in me. I was like, oh, the things I find easy to get obsessed with, like playing video games or the blog or this or that, it's gardening has an element of that to it. It's such a deep field. There's so much you can understand about the whole world. You can tie almost any natural science into gardening. It's also more than half of all life on Earth. So it's like a field you can sink your time into. And you can do something, see how something responds, and then adjust from there, which is, I just like those fields. Like, I was obsessed with skateboarding, which is a super high feedback loop sport, right? And it's a sport of one. Obsessed with rock climbing, it's the same thing. You can try something, you fall, you try something different, you don't fall. And it's the same in the gardens. Like, I want to grow this plant, I failed, what can I change? I succeeded, right? And then you get the benefit of the beautification of your space, you get, you know, the sort of peaceful benefits, you get the food. And so it just all tied together. But you're right, it could have gone a completely different way. It was just totally random that's the one that got chosen at that time.
Yeah. Why do you think it is that you didn't start earlier, and maybe you did start these ventures or properties, but just you haven't spoken about them? Why didn't you start a blog around poker or skateboarding or something else? Why did it take for your brother to say, get interested in gardening, and then you started writing about it?
Well, I had a blog a long time ago called, it's so cringe. It was when I learned about affiliate blogging back in the day. And this is a perfect example of staying power. Like, I was, this one I'm about to share, I just did it to see if I could make a dollar on the internet, right? And it was so stupid. So I had a blog I registered called cocoabuttercream.org. And it was a review blog about cocoa butter cream brands. And that's what I wrote. And so I wrote about every cocoa butter cream brand that I could come up with for stretch marks or for pimple, whatever. And eventually I did make, I think I made like $32.34 or something from that blog. And I was like, oh my God, like, this works, you know, like, the magical money comes from the internet. Like, this is a real thing. And then I was like, what am I doing, dude? Like, this doesn't even make sense. Like, how much time have I sunk into this cocoa butter cream blog to make $32? Like, infinite. Like, it's a percent hourly rate. And so I've had stuff in the past, and, you know, I don't know why I never connected just doing it about something I actually liked. It took until gardening. I have no idea, but I definitely tried a lot of random stuff in the earlier days.
What do you think it was then a function? I mean, obviously there was the interest portion, but then it was also a function of timing, and that blogging maybe, was gaining more steam at the time you started Epic, or why did then you decide to take a second swing at it, even though you'd only made $30 on a ton of hours of investment?
Well, at the time, I was building websites for local San Diego customers. Like, first client I ever had was a guy who sold Letterman jackets in San Diego and was pretty well known for it. But I guess it was a family business and his dad had run it and given it to him. And let's just say he did not run it well. Like, the first site I ever built for him, it got on like our local news as like a scam report because he wasn't delivering people Letterman jackets. And so there's my website that was like, I mean, I wasn't attached to it. It just looked like his site, but still I was like, okay, interesting first client. So I was building websites at the time and I was like, well, why don't I just build one for myself about anything, maybe gardening, because I'm into it right now. And if a client wants to see what I can do, at least something's in my portfolio. I can't show this Letterman jacket guy's website. He's like a scammer, you know? And so initially I was like, it's a fun outlet, but also it's sort of like a digital business card for the services I was providing at the time. And then I got into the SEO side of it. I was like, oh, you can write and gain traffic from Google and this and that. And you're right. It was also a very popular time in blogging. It was sort of the heyday of blogging.
Can you explain your mental evolution from just starting out with this blog? I think at one point you're making like $400 a month. You grew it to where it would cover your expenses, to where now you have millions of subscribers across channels. You're doing millions of dollars in revenue. You've taken on Series A financing. There's a lot of major leaps within there, not to mention the kind of micro steps you took.
Yep.
What was just like the mental evolution, and why have you decided to take such a massive swing as opposed to being content with just building a lifestyle business?
Yeah, that was actually a really big point of contention when deciding to raise the Series A financing in the first place, because I'm not a traditional, like, Epic and a lot of these sort of content commerce style businesses, they're not like VC bets. You know, you're not scaling this out to purple mattress level, nor should you want to. Like, I think it's pretty clear that wasn't a good idea back then even. Most of those companies have sort of crumbled. But it is a growth sort of equity sort of play. And my question when our investors, the Turner Group, came through is I was like, why though? It's the exact question you asked me. I'm like, why? I'm doing really well for myself, certainly better than I thought I'd do as a gardening creator, you know. Honestly, even back then, before raising, like, I would put our numbers up against much larger creators in much larger industries because they hadn't figured out the tie to what was really driving the business, which is the product or the service that you would offer to that audience. I think slightly ahead there compared to most folks in our space. And so I was like, yeah, why? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And once I sort of wrapped my head around what could be done, then I got really excited about it. And I was like, you know what? I could continue on as I'm doing and probably get mired down at some of the operational stuff that was coming down the pipe. Because, I mean, when you're selling almost $10 million a year of product across the United States, like, there's actually a lot of bureaucratic things you have to deal with. Like, you have to deal with sales tax nexus in, I think, 42 states at that time. Okay, how are you going to do that? Do I have to spend a week figuring that out? Well, I have to make the videos and I have to go to the warehouse to pack the orders, right? And so they had come to me at a time where I clearly needed more help, wasn't quite at the point of admitting that. So I was like, well, the team size is me and four contractors. We do almost 10 million. So what's wrong? And the question was, I was profit maximizing to some degree and underinvesting if I wanted to do this next chapter, right? Because you're right, you don't have to. So I think I got excited by that. And I also was like, I actually want to learn some of the stuff that building a larger business will teach me. And this, what a great vehicle to learn all these different skill sets and meet these people who can teach me how supply chains work and how do you scale a customer service team and how do you build out a real production studio, like all that kind of stuff. I just wouldn't have learned it myself, or I wouldn't have learned it anywhere near as fast. So it was a great opportunity to scale up and just like way accelerate my learning.
On the note of learning, you've said elsewhere that all of the things you're doing, if you break them down kind of into their constituent or like atomic pieces, these are not novel things. Like, people have created videos before, they've started a blog, they've sold products on the internet. from somebody looking at your business from the outside, they say, oh, that's daunting. Like, that's a massive endeavor. But it seems like mentally you've broken it down into these tiny chunks and then gone and either sought out answers on how to do that so you don't have to reinvent the wheel, or you've just learned through kind of quick trial and error.
Yeah.
Can you speak a bit about your orientation towards learning that maybe other people lack? Why is it that you've like been able to view it as this small series of events that cumulatively add up to this business that you have now?
Yeah, that's actually, it's weird because I'm me, so I just only think
right.
about it the way.
You can only speculate on it.
I can only speculate, right? So, because you're right, people will come up sometimes, or friends of mine from high school, or, you know, colleagues in the fellow creator space that might have one question on how to grow the commerce side of their business or something, like, well, how did you do that? And they'll explain, and they're like, wow, it seems crazy. I'm like, but it's not. Like, I don't know how else to put it. Like, it's not crazy. There's nothing wild about commerce. Like, that's been going on for thousands of years. The format of it does evolve, of course, right? So, you know, but really functionally what you're doing is the content is the audience, right? That's just today's way of having an audience. Like, maybe back in the day you would have been a radio commentator or something like that. And then you're putting things in boxes, and you have to figure out what the thing you want to put in the box is. Okay, well, maybe there's something off the shelf. Well, if there's not, maybe I have to make it. Well, what do I make? Like, it is just breaking it all down, and then it compounds into something that looks daunting. But, you know, if you were to dive into any particular piece of our business, like let's say just customer service or something, well, it's really just addressing the concerns of the customers. And there's these bits of software we use, and we have these people doing it. They do X, Y, and Z sort of subsets of that field. Like this person manages these three people, two of these three people do the wholesale side, and one person does the D2C side or something. And they're just answering a customer's concern in the best way they can. And then when you scale it all the way out, you're like, oh my God, like that's crazy. But it's in the end, I don't know how else to put it. Like, it's just not like none of these things are novel. None of these things are crazy. You know, Musk has that quote about like, if the laws of physics don't prevent it, then it's possible. Right. And I think I would maybe adjust that and say, like, he's obviously doing something where really the laws of physics better not prevent it
right.
sending things into space, right? But for a more normal human being, I would say, like, if the laws of physics don't prevent it, and you're in a general position where, like, it's not highly improbable, well, then you can definitely do it, right? Like, it's not impossible for me to get into the NBA, but I'm 36 and I never played basketball, so it's probably not happening. Physically, it's probably not impossible, though. So I don't know. There's a bit of a rambly answer there, but that's how I think about it.
No, the simplicity. I had Emmett Shear, the co-founder of Twitch, on several episodes ago, and the simplicity with which you describe it mimics the way he talked about it, which was just like, oh, you just break it down to this piece and you try and do it. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, then you shift your strategy. But
the whole world as a scientific method, basically, I guess is the way you would put it. Like, the scientific method applies to all things, not just for the pursuit of an experiment in science, right? You know, so if I think saying PS at the end of a customer service email and then sending them a link to the video that most solves their problem will help our customer service scores, then I'll say, go try that. And then we'll figure out if it does or doesn't improve.
Right.
So you're sort of running experiments all the time.
I think it's that mixed with the granularity of the experiment you're running, which makes it feel more feasible.
It has to be controlled in a way.
Exactly. This kind of like scientific method approach to learning is almost a mental model in a sense. And I don't know if you still are very fascinated by mental models, but there was a period, at least on your personal blog, where you would talk about them frequently as kind of a meta setup to this question. What is the 80-20 or the Pareto principle approach to mental models that matter for you? What are the ones, the one, two, or three that you've revisited time and time again in your life and have found incredibly useful?
Well, the hyper meta answer is that the Pareto principle is one of those three, you know? So that's the irony of it all, I guess, is, you know, I read Poor Charlie's Almanac back in the day. Mm-hmm. And this was before, you know, the book on mental models came out from, I think, Gabriel Weinberg. He wrote one. Obviously, you know, guys like Eric Jorgensen put out the Nahalmanac, which is effectively a version of that. I think the 80-20 principle is exceptionally helpful, especially if you're a creator or like a executive or something where you're just not actively doing the work in a particular department of your business. You're sort of watching from the top and guiding and moving the pieces around. Well, you have to know which pieces are the most important and how to move them in such a way that the output is increased, right? And you don't have to make that many moves. Like if you're, you know, shuffling the board all the time, you're like, okay, well, I'm making these like sort of incremental gains. Whereas you sit there, I don't know, it's like how Messi plays soccer, right? He's like kind of wandering around the field and then he's just magically right in the right place. I sort of admire that and strive for those types of moves. So 80-20, I would say just the principle of compounding in general, understanding the power of compounding and how and the many ways in which it applies, because it applies to so many different things. Like, let's say you're like relational compounding, maybe like maybe the relationship you have to your audience. Like if every video you put out, you're adding to that bank and not drawing from it, it's very hard to not win. You know, if you're continuing to build affinity and output value to your audience in fresh and new ways every time you put a video out versus sort of stagnating or maybe hard selling too much in your content, the long game you will win, because if you tie that to word of mouth, which is really the only free marketing that exists on earth, that's the only way to increase that. So I would go 80-20 in compounding, and then I'm trying to think of a good third here. One third I would maybe put forth would be that in a sense, sort of nothing matters. And in that sense, like everything matters, I guess. I don't know if that makes much sense, but
it makes to me, a lot like, of sense. Been thinking about that a lot lately.
It's the paradox of life. Like I think all interesting sort of realizations about life devolve into it basically is a paradox, right? Like the whole quote of how you do anything is how you do everything. That would imply that every action you take has some sort of deep significance, deep meaning, like the way I get up in the morning and treat my girlfriend or this or that over the course of many, many days is very impactful, right? At the same time, then you go, well, what about the Pareto principle? I thought only a small amount of inputs increases the outputs. And it's like, well, that's true sometimes, but not true everywhere, right? And so to me, I eventually go like, you have to build almost like a taste making ability to decide which sort of concept to apply in your life at which exact moment in time. And that's the hardest thing I think to teach anyone on earth. Like, I don't even know if it's truly teachable by someone to someone else.
Mental models are often something that people try to kind of like accumulate like a collection, and they're just kind of adding more and more lessons and kind of lenses to through which to view the world. But I think often subtracting things or identifying things that you should stop doing or stop believing is arguably more useful and impactful. What is one of the biggest things that you've had to unlearn either personally or professionally while building your business in order for you to take kind of that next leap or that next step function change, and again, life or business?
There's been a lot, I think, in the last 18 months, because after raising...
We can go through all of them if you want.
Yeah, after raising our Series A, I mean, we went from me and an editor, a garden assistant, a customer service / executive assistant, and a writer, that's it, to we're now at 80 people, roughly. 80 wow. people across, you know, two major hubs in San Diego and Colorado, and then we have a distributed team as well. You know, you're still the CEO. And of course, we have a president at the company who is exceptionally helpful in, you know, providing leverage on day-to-day operations and a lot, honestly, a lot of the business tasks that I'm just inherently not very strong at. But the biggest change, one of the biggest changes for me is realizing which hat I'm wearing when and acting in accordance to that. So, you know, today it's, if I'm chatting with you, and I was just on another podcast, this is sort of like the CEO face hat, where I'm just having a conversation and hopefully sharing, and maybe this helps and benefits our company in some way. And, you know, it's also just inherently interesting to have these conversations. I think I'm enjoying it. But, you know, after this, I'll have a meeting with our whole team, which that's the CEO hat again. But then at 2 p.m. today, I'm back in full creator mode. Like, I have to forget about all the business things completely, all the interpersonal dynamics, that maybe someone has an issue with someone else on the team, or they have an issue with me or whatever, issue with the products, and then just go full on YouTuber mode and be on the camera, having a good time, right? Like thinking about how to structure the content. And so that's been quite challenging. And I don't think I do a great job at it still some days. Some days I'm just like, my CEO hat's still on when I'm trying to film, and I'm like, this isn't working, right? Or vice versa. So that's been a big one. And I think also understanding that at the level of this organization or the level of this scale, you stop being the person who's doing the actual manipulation of the world. Like I'm not editing the video. I'm not making the thumbnail. And in some areas of the company, I'm telling the person who's telling the person what we should be focusing on, right? So the layers and the stacks are now really interesting. And so then I've realized, oh, you can't just, it's not as robotic as I used to think. It's not just like, well, tell this person that, and then they'll go do that. It's just not how it works in leadership and management. And so, you know, it's the whole interpersonal side of things that I just never had to deal with in the past. And so it's an underdeveloped skill set that I'm trying to get better at as much as I can.
Which of those hats or which of those kind of muscle groups or skill groups do you most miss having hands-on exposure or experience with? And which have you most enjoyed taking on or learning in your new roles?
Yeah, I think thankfully, especially as we've hired up a great team, thankfully the stuff that I would have missed giving up, I have not given up, right? So I still get to make the content, I get to make it on a higher level. And then, you know, a great example of a new skill set I've liked developing is we recently acquired a blog from a colleague, I guess, loosely affiliated from the early blogging days. He built a great gardening blog. We acquired his blog and hired him as our lead sort of editorial. He runs all the written content for Epic. And it's been really fun to work with him as a true partner in that area of the business. You know, he'll come to me with proposals on hiring different staff members, what it will mean for him in the business unit. We'll come up with ideas on how to better tie the blog to the commerce offerings that we have. And so I'm literally not doing any of that. But I do feel it's really cool to kind of workshop ideas and have someone you trust go execute them. In a sense, it's almost like more like you're gardening than you're farming. In that sense, like I'm cultivating with him a strategy that gets executed by him and his team. But it's very satisfying to see it play out in the way that you wanted it to. So I think that's what you would strive for as a leader.
You've made, I believe, a few acquisitions now, in part fueled by that funding. I'm sure you have far more heuristics and kind of understanding about how to identify good companies to acquire and how to execute on that. What is the highest leverage thing for you to identify during due diligence? Yeah. And I imagine it was something that you weren't thinking about before you started these kinds of acquisitions. But what's the number one thing to be looking for that's an indicator of future success of that business?
Yeah, so the big acquisition we made was our seed company, Botanical Interests. Weirdly, one of the first seed packs I ever grew when I first went out with my brother. So full circle moment for sure.
Cool.
That one was a more complex transaction than some of the other acquisitions we've made. So that one, we actually leaned quite a bit due diligence wise on the help of our investors. They helped us quite a bit there. But I would say on a high level, if we talk through, maybe I've done one physical product acquisition that was smaller than that and one digital with the blog. And I found both of those. And so the way I thought about it, and these are sub-million dollars, but not insignificant and not like, you know, 50K or anything like that. I think I'm quite good in that range. And the reason why is because if I can find a few different ways that that can win as the base case, like if the base case underwrites, let's just say, take the blog. The blog costs a certain amount of money to buy. It makes a certain amount of money on ad revenue. And if that just, that very simplistic sort of payback period of ad revenue to cost to acquire is reasonable, then I go, okay, cool. Well, let's entertain it then. And then I just start hunting. Like, I'm like, how else does this multiplicatively affect the business? And in that particular case, buying that blog doubled our own ad revenue on Epic's blog because the combined traffic pumped us into a tier with our ad network that gave us a higher cut. So I go, okay, well, it underwrote for the most part as the base case. Now I have this additive effect there. Then I said, well, when you merge that blog into our blog, the Epic Gardening blog is a stronger web property in the eyes of Google. So it wouldn't, in theoretically, it shouldn't be a one-to-one traffic transfer. If 10 million sessions are being redirected from the blog we're buying to the blog, to my blog, I think based on like basic understanding of SEO and our domain strength, et cetera, maybe you underwrite a 10 to 30% increase in the sessions that are derived from those pages. So I go, and that would also be applied at the doubled revenue rate, right? So I go, okay, well then add that in. And then I go, well, it's all going to our property now. So email signups should increase. And if traffic doubles, they should roughly double. And maybe you apply some sort of decrement on that because the traffic's slightly less qualified or something like that. So you say, call it, you know, email subs go up by 20%. Then you go, well, what would 20% more email subscribes over a year do based on how we know that email converts to sales? You know what I mean? Like, you just keep mathing it all the way out. And I'm like, okay, well, this just seems like an obvious move. Like, you don't even, I was ready to write the check. I'm like, I don't even need to do any diligence except for making sure that the site's not like a scam or something, you know?
Right.
But I was like, this is so obvious, you'd be idiotic not to do it, you know? And that's the ones I kind of try to look for. It was somewhat similar with our physical product pickup, where it was even more obvious though, because in that one, I was the sole dropship supplier of that product. I brought it basically to market with the inventor, Diego, who's on our product team, and it just ripped. Like, I knew it was a good product the second I saw it, and I was very excited to sell it, but we became such a large percentage of Diego's sales that there was really no other option. We were 90-something percent of all of his revenue in that product line, and so I was like, dude, I think we could do a lot together. I think this line of product could be 10 more SKUs. I think there's a lot of room. It's clearly our customers love it. Like, why don't you just join? And, you know, I think to date we're somewhere up like 5.5 to 6 times return on that particular investment. Wow. From like acquisition cost to revenue generated in the time frame. So yeah, I don't know how else to put it. That's kind of how I think about it. It's somewhat simplistic. It's basically like, if I could find 7 ways it wins, then clearly it must be good. You know, it's not very sophisticated.
Right. Although it's become a bit of a meme, it sounds like the summary there is synergies identifying.
Yeah. But in a way that's real, like you actually you have to validate, right? Like, is this are all these assumptions actually what's going to happen? You know?
One of the interesting things you've done that I don't think many other creators have, or at least if they've tried to do it, they haven't done it successfully. It's kind of crossing this chasm from trying to get audience content fit to product market fit. So moving from a content business to actually selling products. And you started with selling, I think, gardening beds during COVID or pre-COVID. And now you have a whole array of lines. You've acquired other businesses that have lines. And I understand this is a bit of apples to oranges. But on the whole, is it harder to find audience content fit or product market fit? And what has that journey been like, or experience been like, going from one to the other?
Yeah, I think any creator kind of has the cheat code here, and it's super unfair. And that's why you see these creator businesses just completely coming out of nowhere and just smacking legacy players in the face. Like when you look at Beast or Logan Paul, like, you look at Feastables to do like nearly 200 million probably in 18 months or 24 months, like that's just destroying the speed at which you could build most CPG brands, which is just, it's just insane. And, but why though? Like you just have to ask, why did that happen? He has super, arguably the best audience content fit of all time. If you think about his audience, he's decided is Earth, right? Which is insane. And he gets, you know, on average now, what, 300 million views a video? So he gets like a significant percentage of Earth to watch his video. And then he just sells them something that everyone on Earth would like, which is chocolate, right? It's genius. So for me, it makes sense to find audience content fit first, because that's the cheat code that gives you the product market fit. What I see, and I still see this because, you know, there's a lot of gardening creators realizing this and trying to make products themselves, or there's other people in other industries. And a lot of people are still stuck on the old model of just saying, well, I think this product is a good idea in this market. I'm going to try to get some funding to create it, and then I'm going to see if it sells. And I'm like, look, good luck. I don't envy that process when I don't have to do that. You know, I can just say, well, I know we don't have any trellises on our store right now. I've made many videos on trellises, and I also know trellises are very popular in gardening. Like, obviously, some plants climb. You need something to put them on. So why don't I figure out how to offer the best trellis to our audience? Like, it's an auto win. If I offer something that's good, that people love, I have an unfair advantage at selling it, at identifying the changes you might make to improve the product. It was the same exact story with these seed cells I just talked about. It was like, well, I know everyone uses those. I use them. This is the best one I've ever seen. I'll just tell the people that are into seed starting, which is my audience, about it. And that's all you had to do. So it's a luxury, I guess, because you have to get the audience content fit first, which is, I would say, probably the harder thing to do.
On another podcast episode, it actually might have been Making Media as well, you had this, you referred to this really cool strategy via an analogy to Marvel and kind of the cinematic universe that they've built, and how you kind of start, I mean, they started with Iron Man, then they layered in other characters, they did spinoffs, you bring them back together, and you allow kind of this natural selection to take place within the market, where you let the consumer tell you, oh yeah, we like this new character, we don't like this new character. Can you talk a bit about, and maybe I just, that was a bit of a leading question, but can you elaborate more on why you love that model so much and how you're trying to do that with Epic?
Yeah, I love it because it allows you to remove probably the biggest Achilles heel of a business model like ours, which is me. If something happens to me, who's making the videos? Who's directing the blog strategy? Who's, right? Like the unfair advantage that I just spoke about, audience content fit, defining product market fit, and sort of hacking around this sort of business building process goes away if the person who knows how to do that is gone, right? Not to say I'm going to be gone, but I could be. I could get like smashed by something tomorrow, right? So you then say, okay, well, the thing that got you here will get you there in a sense. So can I run the next 5 years of Epic Gardening as a YouTube channel, short form media channel, et cetera, podcast host, all these things? It's just me? For sure I could, but it wouldn't be smart for me. It wouldn't be smart for our employees, and it wouldn't be smart for our investors for me to do that, because what happens if something happens to me? So then I said, okay, well, how do you solve this problem though? Because it got here because of me. It now needs to get to the next place with me, but not solely because of me. So how do I do that? Because the audience is used to just me, you know? And so what I started to do even before taking on any money was Jacques on our team, he was my original garden assistant. I just started showing him in our content and sort of beta testing him, so to speak, as like someone, as a personality. And people really built an affinity to him. They liked him, super genuine guy, nice guy. And so then I was like, why don't we make you a YouTube channel? And this is a geologist at the time, is still working on his geology PhD. You know, like, wow. He hadn't been on camera. But we filmed the videos. And that's the interesting thing, is like, you wouldn't pick him out of a pot of 100 players and be like, he's going to be the guy who has, in a year and a half, 300K on every platform. You know, and that's nothing against him. that's just the truth of underwriting a person. You wouldn't be like, this geology PhD who's never been on camera and is a very modest guy, which is a great strength of his. You wouldn't say he's going to be the one. And that's why I like that natural selective process. It's like, you need to let the audience tell you who they do and don't connect to, and give them enough time to cook so that the audience can say, well, I've really come around to this person, right? And so that's what I'm trying to do now on all of our channels is, how can I introduce people who offer something fresh and different than what I might offer, and see where the audience bips up and goes, oh, whoa, like, I need more of Anna, or I need more of, you know, Melissa, or whoever it might be. Or, you know, I really want to learn about arranging flower pots, and this woman is incredible at teaching me. Like, I'm not going to be that good at that. So this is my sort of solution for trying to make the business less dependent on if I decide to wake up and make the next video or not, right? And I think about this a lot. Like, if you think about these other creators, if you take a look at Jimmy's stuff, like, you go, he's not really done that. Like, what happens if his brain goes away? The whole thing just crumbles, I think, which I don't think is ideal, you know? So that's the way to think about it, at least for me.
What's an inevitable truth about the creator space that might be unpopular, but you're pretty confident about?
Yeah, this one I've said, I think, before, and I think I've developed a little bit of an even more extreme take on it. And it would be that I actually think a lot of these creator businesses are going to zero or back to lifestyle mode after they realize they can't figure out how to do it at the next level, because of what I just talked about. Like, it can get you way faster to a certain level than other business models can. So like, you can hack your way to, you know, a $15 million coffee pod business or something faster if you had a creator with you, right? But then the advantage starts to go away as far as how impactful being the creator is. And it starts being like, is that product actually legitimately good? And is it a better market entrant, or is it not, you know? And so that's what I've always told the team, is I was like, the stuff we make and bring to market, if I don't exist, or if none of our content exists, they still have to want to pick that one up off the shelf, because then you really can't beat us. Then we have the functionally better product, as if we developed it like a true product company might have. And we have the best content in the world telling you that it's over there, right? And I think most creators get to a certain level and they sort of arb out the fact that they have the audience and they can just direct to basically a Me Too product, you know? And then once that kind of runs out, they're like, oh, that was, yeah, I'm just not that interested in doing the rest of this stuff. And I just actually am interested in that. And hopefully that's what will take us to the next level. But I think a lot of these creator businesses, it's a Me Too sort of product. They'll cash cow it for a little bit and then it'll go away.
The number one criteria you've mentioned elsewhere when it comes to deciding what kind of content create is just whether it's interesting to you, whether it's something that you want to make, you want to see out in the world. There is kind of authenticity to that. Why do you start with authenticity, and what are the trade-offs of doing that? Because some would argue it is easier to kind of pander to your audience and just create content for the sake of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've evolved that a bit. Like, it can't just be interesting to me. If it was, then I would put out a lot of videos that probably wouldn't do so well, you know, because I'd go into some esoteric plant science thing or something. It's just too deep for a channel of 2.something million. Maybe there's another channel I could do it on. But I think there is a level, and we talk about that authenticity thing a lot with our team and our creators. It's like, I'm not just going to push, let's say a product is slow, right? We've picked up a product. We think it was good. It's not selling as well as we thought. Maybe we missed on something. It's just not that popular. It's not that good, whatever. Well, you might say, well, then push that product to get it discounted and push it out. I'm like, no, like if I do that on our channels, then you trust my word slightly less, because if I know the product's slow, it's slow for a reason. And so maybe I shouldn't push it, accept the L and push something that's better, that people like. And that's the hardest, I think, part about this whole thing, is you're balancing all these competing priorities as you make the content. So that's a big one. I do think you have to be excited about what you make to some degree though. So I'm trying to like craft ways that I can get excited about a more basic concept video. Like let's say I was to do, how to grow peas from start to finish, which I think I've already done actually now that I think about it, but I've grown peas a million times. It's not inherently that exciting to me. So I'm like, okay, well, how do I make this video exciting to me? So I come across well and I feel energized making it. And how do I make it the most palatable and explainable and understandable to the basic gardener, which is, that's why that video needs to be made, you know? So it's always a balance, I think, but sometimes we'll throw a pander video in there, you know, we'll do a reaction to some viral TikToks or something like that. And those are fun too. So.
Stepping away from the business for a second, but staying within, kind of agriculture at large. You had this awesome video in 2019 where you tried to live off your property, your 150 square foot garden for 30 days.
Yeah.
And the short of it is that you couldn't do it. You resorted to fishing and foraging and you lost like 13 pounds in the process.
Yeah.
So most people are not growing any of their own food. What appreciation did that process give you for kind of our globalized access to food? And maybe more importantly, what kind of, and this is probably something you've thought about far more than I have, but what kind of concerns did that bring to the forefront about the fragility of kind of our global food supply chain?
Yeah, I mean, I think experiment wise, it could have been designed better. Like I think 150 square feet was just like too small, but honestly, there's a quote, I forgot exactly who it's attributed to, but it's like the world's always 3 days away from like riots, because if the food system is interrupted for that long, like it's just going to be absolutely right. And it's not, thankfully, because we do have a global food system, but I think people are like unaware of the sheer complexity of how many different things are in that store that they go into and how many different processes literally around the whole earth are taking place to get it to them in the way that they want. And then we were just having a podcast yesterday about this on our show about there's almost a question as we go forward in on earth, I think, of like, should you want it all the time? Like, should you expect strawberries and tomatoes and guava and passion fruit in New York in winter? I think probably it's reasonable to say no, to some of it at least. And the reason I go that route is I go, if you understand how passion fruit grows, or take dragon fruit, that's an even better example because that doesn't store very well. Should everyone on earth want everything at their fingertips all the time if they understood the externalities of actually getting that done? It's easy to say yes because you want the world to be better, but if you understand the externalities of getting it to every functional place on earth at all times of year, it's so destructive to the overall ecosystem of our planet that it's basically like compressing the human existence into like maybe five-ish generations where we live like absolute gods, and then after that we're all screwed, you know? But you don't care because you're one of the five, you know? And so I don't know. To me, that's how I feel. And I think it's a hard sell to get other people to agree with it, though, because it's obviously nice to have things when you want them.
On the note of kind of this balance between maybe growing locally or growing yourself versus access to this global food supply, at least in my corner of Twitter, people have romanticized this idea of homesteading. And kind of this return to the past where you own your land, you own it from seed to table. To generalize for a second, is this something that you think is realistic and we should aspire to, or do we, albeit maybe we want to modify this global supply chain, like we accept the crazy dependence on it?
I think it's kind of like Matrix and Zion, you know, like some people are going to go to Zion because they can't accept the Matrix. And that'll be the people who are full on homesteaders, you know? And because the truth is, like, if you want to do that way, you're good. You don't actually need much from the modern world if you want to. We clearly we did it for thousands of years, right? So you actually don't need much. So if you want to go that hardcore, it's certainly a path available to you. And hopefully information out there today allows you to kind of travel that path. My old boss at Book in a Box, Scribe Media, Tucker, he's basically doing that. He's like building his own school out in Austin in the community. So he's going full on. And that's awesome, I think. I think most the real truth is most people won't do that. I would love to see people doing some version of that, like picking their favorite thing that they want to start supplying themselves and or just getting locally. Like there's going to be a local person that you could probably get your eggs from compared to getting them from a big, you know, Tyson farm out in Ohio or whatever. That's way better. And honestly better for you too. And hopefully, you know, if more people make the choice economically, it actually gets cheaper as well. So I think the most likely case is some people will be hardcore and hopefully a large chunk, maybe a plurality of the population goes towards the shift model. Because the truth is not everyone's going to want to do it. And that's just, that's fine.
Yeah. In closing, there's one question I ask every guest, which is what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with whether to think about or act on?
I would say to someone listening, if you want to do something, let's say you're not doing something that you want to be doing right now. And if you want to do something, get real about if you actually want it or you just like the idea of doing it. There's a few folks that I've mentored for a long time about building businesses online, like blogs, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the core problem, and you can see it correlated to the levels of success that they have, is there's too much good stuff going on outside of that, that they don't really actually want to do it because the path is right there. It's not, like I've mentioned, like it's just sequencing a bunch of these different steps that have been proven out time and time again. And I think the truth is if you get really, really down to it, they don't actually really want to do it that bad. Because if you did, it would for sure be happening. And I'm not saying it'd be an epic level success or whatever, but it would certainly be enough to achieve that thing. And so it's okay to not want to do something if you admit it. And then you save yourself the head wringing or the hand wringing of like, like I want to be an entrepreneur or this or that. It's like, maybe you just don't though, you know? So maybe get real about how deeply you want to do some of these things you think you want to do. I've had to do that recently of like, I really like music. There's a guitar right there, but I don't have the time or the deep desire to get as good as I wish I wanted to get at it. And so I'm just not going to, maybe later in life, but I would leave people with that. Maybe it's a little depressing. Hopefully not.
No, not at all. I think it's realistic. It's practical. Are there any heuristics for people to distinguish between the thing that they think they want versus they really want? Or is it as simple yet hard as just like being honest and doing the self-reflection necessary to get there?
Yeah, I think it's probably that. I think also the risk tolerance that you have, like try to understand how much risk tolerance you really have, or what types of risk even. Like there's so many different types. Like if you were to quit your job in corporate or something and do a mommy blog, you might just actually not want to do it because everyone's going to think you're weird. And you actually really care about what people think, right? Whereas someone like myself, like I literally could have cared less. And even my family in the early days, they were like, what is this guy doing with this gardening blog? This makes no sense. Like, how is this going to do anything? And then now, of course, you know, oh, this is amazing, this and that, right?
Right.
So I don't know. There's not a great heuristic here. It's deep, deep internal discovery, I would suggest.
Fair. Great. Well, Kevin, really appreciate your time. This was a fun conversation.
Yeah. Likewise, man.